Construction meets the world's most popular board game in new Monopoly Construction Edition. Amass or possibly lose great fortunes. Every space on the board is packed with both iconic construction brands and incredible infrastructure projects in this new exciting edition of Monopoly. You'll need to make smart decisions to come out on top. Have you got what it takes to succeed in the world of construction? Search Construction Monopoly to order now.
Welcome to another episode of Reconstruction, the weekly podcast from the Construction Index. It's Wednesday, 15th of April 2020. I'm David Taylor, editor of TCI Magazine, that's the Construction Index magazine. And with me as usual is Phil Bishop, editor of our daily online news service. We're also joined today by a special guest who we'll introduce in just a moment. But first, Phil, I thought it would be a good idea if you could quickly update us on any main news topics which might happen to be worth discussing.
Well, the big story from this morning is the announcement from the Department of Transport that they have given HS2, the high-speed rail between London and Birmingham, that's the phase one bit of HS2, they've given it what's called notice to proceed, which we knew was coming when the Prime Minister in February announced that he was going to go ahead with the project amid much controversy. It was said then that this next green light should come before the end of April, and lo and behold, surprise, surprise, they've done what they said they were going to do. They've given notice to proceed before the end of April. And from my point of view, I think this is tremendous news. I mean, it's not a surprise. It's another green light, and it's the greenest green light we've had yet. I think it's the last and final green light for this part of the project, the London to Birmingham stage of the project. Not everyone will agree it's a good thing, of course. There'll be a lot of people thinking, especially in the current environment, £100 billion could be better spent on the National Health Service. Other people think it would be better spent on improving existing infrastructure or improving broadband connectivity or whatever. But going into the economic decline that we're destined for, it's not an either or. And from my point of view, thank goodness we've got a Chancellor who in this house is known as Rish the Dish or Dishy Rishi, is spending spending the money. God bless him. And we need to spend money on capital investment, because the private sector is not going to get us out of this mess. It's got to be public spending, projects like this. The only thing that people might be slightly concerned about is of the £12 billion worth of contracts that are going ahead now, only £3.5 billion are going to UK firms or firms that are UK owned. But that doesn't mean to say that the other 7.5 billion is leaving the country. Of course, it's only the, if they're lucky, 2% profit that they might make on that, which may leave the country. So what we have to hope for now is the supply chain is going to do all the real work, where all the money is being spent on. Hope for as British a supply chain as possible to keep the money in the country.
Absolutely,
But it's good news. But it is a shame that we've only got Costain, Kier, Balfour Beatty and McAlpine, are British companies, although you could argue that because Costain, Kier and Balfour Beatty are publicly listed, and who knows where their ultimate shareholders reside, with these sort of American banks or other banks. And one could argue that McAlpine is the only pure British name amongst that lot. Otherwise, they're all French, Dutch, Spanish, Swedish and Austrian companies. But it's all good news, and we're looking forward to
take comfort where we can get it. I mean, it's a real shot in the arm, isn't it?
Yeah. Just when we needed it.
Yeah, okay. Well, look, I think the time now is right to introduce our special guest. Joining us today, remotely, of course, is Steve Hadley. Steve is Managing Director. Is it Managing Director, Steve, or Chief Executive? How do you like to be introduced?
Managing Director. I'm quite hands-on.
Managing Director of Central Piling, the Essex-based piling specialist, a company which has grown rapidly over the last 10 years or so. I think the last time we spoke, Steve, was a couple of years ago, and you just opened up a new office in Knaresborough up in Yorkshire, hadn't you? And we're looking to expand But Steve is joining us today because he's in the news himself. He's just been appointed as chairman of the Federation of Piling Specialists, which is the trade association for his particular sector. So he has a certain weight of responsibility on his shoulders now. And I thought maybe we could start off, Steve, start our discussion, perhaps for the benefit of those people who aren't familiar with ground engineering, perhaps civilian listeners or people who are new to the industry. Can you explain what a piling specialist is and what you do?
Yeah, of course. First of all, David, thanks so much for having me on and the opportunity to speak to your listeners about the piling industry. So piles are a form of foundation, deep foundation. What our members do, they're contractors, they offer a design and build service and create these deep foundations to transmit loads from structures like tower blocks, bridges, schools, hospitals, you name a type of building, and our members will be providing solutions to support it.
Piles are these deep columns, usually concrete or steel columns, deep into the ground to support the buildings, aren't they?
That's right. So listeners will have passed drilling rigs, look like big corkscrews. there are our continuous flight auger piling rigs, and they drill holes in the ground. We fill them with concrete and steel, and that transmits the load to the ground without the building settling too much. And we also use piles to form retaining walls. There's various other types of techniques, but it's all about trying to understand how to create structures that can support earth and support buildings without causing too much deflection or settlement.
So it's a sector that is literally fundamental to the construction industry.
Can I ask, if you're a piling company that specialises in drilling piles, in bored piles, do you not then do the driven piles, the ones which are banged and hammered into the ground? Are they different companies, or would all your members do all kinds of solutions?
We do both. Lots of our members will do both, but people tend to specialise. So I would say the vast majority of our work at Central Piling is in CFA piling. The board piling, rotary board piling, which is slightly different technique from CFI piling. We do plenty of that. But we also do driven steel piling and precast piling. And there's various different situations, probably too expansive a subject to discuss here, why you would use different solutions on different project. But it's fair to say that different contractors will find strengths in certain areas, and people will go to them because of that.
Yeah. So the Federation, this body that you're now the new chairman of, what's the role? I mean, what do you do for your members?
The role of the FPS, like a lot of trade bodies, is to share information and promote best practice and defend the rights of its members. So particularly in the areas of health and safety, we've got a proven track record of producing documentation and ensuring that the wider construction industry is aware of some of the issues. The working platform document that the Federation of Piling Specialists produced a few years ago, a great example of that. You know, our members were going to sites that they weren't particularly well prepared. There was risks of machines turning over, and you're talking about massive bits of kit. Some of them are weighing up to 120 tons, and the surface that they were working on just weren't adequate in a lot of cases. And so there was procedures that were put in place. There was design documents that were created around working platform design, and it really moves the subject forward. And that's just one example. But even this year, we've produced documents on harm reduction for the splicing of reinforcement cages, which is an area that we'd noted that there was injuries, the mechanised handling of drilling tools, and safe working areas around machines. We're also very conscious about occupational health. and mental health. So we've aligned ourselves this year with Mates in Mind, a great charity, and we've already started working with them to push out information to our members. Right. It's actually Stress Awareness Month, and actually couldn't come at a more important time to get those messages out. Yeah. There's a lot of people that are very isolated at the moment and feeling the pressure.
So the Federation is very much about promoting best practice. Mm-hmm. Are you in any way, do you police members at all? I mean, is there a threshold to join, or do people have to get better or perform a certain way to stay a member? Because I know some federations, they don't like to throw people out. And
we're unapologetic about having high standards. And I can say, hand on heart, we probably audit our members to a higher standard than any of the other processes that we go through, all the various accreditations. And there's plenty of them out there that we have to sign up to, which is probably a subject for another podcast. But the FPS standards is an extremely high standard. We audit our members every 3 years. The bar is raised every 3 years. And there's new subjects that go in, actually, in the next round, part of the Occupational Health Charter that we did last year. One of the things that we're going to be looking at in the next round of audits is ensuring that there's regular health surveillance, drugs and alcohol testing that members are doing. That's going to form part of the auditing process.
Do people ever fail that, though, or do they just keep coming back?
Don't get me wrong, we give people the opportunity to improve, but there have been failures. People have failed to join. It is tough. And all right, we are a voice for the industry as well. But by value, we probably represent about 80% of the value of work. One of the things that I think I can help bring to the Federation of Pioneer Specialists, though, is maybe an appreciation of some of the challenges that smaller businesses encounter. So Central Piling, they are an SME, so we're currently 16 million turnover. So we'd be sort of medium sized for a member of our federation. But obviously we've come from a place where we were a lot smaller than that. And we do understand some of the challenges that come with working on smaller sites. In terms of the number of people working within the piling industry, there's lots and lots of people working on very confined sites for private customers, and they come with different challenges. So it's good that we can get a voice for some of those problems within the leadership of the Federation of Piling Specialists as well.
Central Piling, I mean, is an SME, but I mean, when we did our last sort of analysis of the sector, you were amongst the top 20 by turnover in the country. So is it a sector that's dominated by SMEs? I mean, there's a few big ones, of course, Expanded right at the top and much bigger than anybody else.
Yeah,
is it basically SMEs?
Probably in terms of the number of people within the different businesses, there's the majority is SMEs. But you've in terms of looking at the turnover, probably getting on for 50% of the turnover is from larger businesses. So you've got Balfour Beatty Ground Engineering, Cementation Skanska, Bashley Solitanche, Expanded, you mentioned, all approaching 100 million turnover. Yeah. Van Al have joined that party as well. So there are a handful of extremely large businesses, and then lots of SMEs.
How many members does the FPS have at the moment?
We've got approaching 20 full members, but we've also got lots of associate members. So we opened it up a couple of years ago to get some of the talent that had left the industry, particularly in technical areas. So people that set up their own geotechnical consultancies that we use by members on a regular basis. And we wanted to have benefits of their expertise within our technical committees. Also, suppliers, so plant manufacturers and material suppliers have joined. And again, fed fed their experiences and know-how into some of the discussions and the projects that our various committees are working on.
And is it a sector that's developing technologically? I mean, is it you think about drilling holes in the ground and filling with concrete, fairly basic stuff, but it's a little bit more sophisticated than that nowadays, isn't it? And there's a lot of design work. There's more design work for the FPS members to do.
Yeah, the in all aspects, it's moved on. So you pick up on the point on about design. So that, you know, the simplistic nature of the design when I came into the industry, you know, hand calculations, the very basic spreadsheets. We're now regularly using finite element software to analyze not just what's happening at the position of the pile or the retaining wall, but what's happening 10, 15, 20 meters away to look at how it impacts neighbors and structures and services. So there's some pretty complex engineering going into the design in terms of the equipment we're using. We're able to dial into all that equipment, so I could literally now click on a link and see, hopefully, if my guys are busy, some piles going into the ground, how much concrete is being fed in. The key parameters for us are production, but also concrete consumption. So we obviously try and prioritise reducing the amount of concrete waste we're producing. And so being able to look at how the foreman is drilling the pile is pretty crucial. So, really using that technology well. The plant is moving on all the time. It's getting more efficient. We've been working with the government in terms of the legislation that's come through with the, particularly in London, the NRMM regulations are changing the engine types that we're using. So,
is this the emissions regulation?
That's right. So the amount of nitrous oxide and carbon emissions coming out of our plant will reduce. There's even Liebherr have produced an electric piling rig.
Have they?
I don't believe it's in the UK yet. Somebody will. Sure, type in if that's not the case. But, you know, the technology is there. Of course, you still got the support, and getting electricity supplies on site at an early stage is going to be a challenge in itself. It's no good if you've got an electric piling rig, but you've got a big compressor with, you know, powered by diesel around the corner. Things are moving on all the time, but...
Can I ask a question about another question about the design of piles? I can understand that if you're in a greenfield site, you take some boreholes, you find out what the ground conditions are, and you work out how heavy the building is, and you work out what foundations you need, and that's relatively straightforward. But a lot of, if not most of construction, certainly urban construction, takes place on land that's already been developed. And you've got, in London, you've got all these tunnels and cables and pipes and tubes and everything underneath the ground, and on existing building sites where building has been demolished, there's all the piles from the and the foundations from the previous buildings. How do you work out what foundations you need for a building where you might not be able to sink piles because of all the underground stuff that's already there? And to what extent can you reuse piles that are already there, which maybe have been there for 100 years or more, and you don't really know how solid they are. How do you work that one out?
There's a few different points, but I think you can sort of collect them in terms of saying you need some really good investigation. So start off with a good desk study, see what the history of the site is, then try and design the ground investigation to suit that in terms of the depth of the borehole investigation. You might then find that actually your boreholes aren't going into good grounds, and you need to go a bit deeper because the potential solutions will be a lot deeper. And so it can be a bit of an iterative process, but always recommend that clients engage with a member of the Federation of Piling Specialists as soon as they possibly can in the construction process and take our advice. Yeah, people are reusing foundations, but it is crucial in those circumstances to have really good records of how the piles were constructed.
Who keeps that? Do local authorities keep that, or is it just the companies themselves?
They would do. We tend to keep our records for 12 years as a minimum. But yeah, local authorities or the clients. So I suppose if a developer's going to purchase a site, try and purchase the records of the foundations and everything that went on the site previously, and potentially they can be reused. Often that is difficult because it's simply not of the size or not in the position that they can be reused. So there's certainly challenges there.
But normally when they knock a building down, it's to put a bigger one up, isn't it?
Exactly, yeah, yeah. So it's still pretty seldom that they can be reused, but it's certainly not impossible.
What sort of shape is the sector in at the moment, Steve? I mean, the COVID-19 pandemic is having an effect. What's the general state of health of piling in the UK at the moment?
Yeah, it's been a difficult period. If go back to the last recession, as the previous low point, we really picked up through the through the last 10 years, and then the last probably 18 months has been a lull. So we've seen two things that have been really challenging for our members, and that's clearly Brexit and the uncertainty around that, leading to a lot of private developers particularly being unwilling to go forward with projects. In fact, in the week after the election, we received a huge amount of orders because
really.
Yeah, developers were buoyed with confidence.
So you were set for a really, really good 2020, weren't you?
We were, yeah. And the news about HS2, that's a massive game changer. And we were super excited. And I thought, I'm coming in as chair in April. This is all set up for me really well. I can sit back, enjoy the next 2 years. We'll be having parties all the time, celebrating our success because we'll be awash with money. But obviously the pandemic has been really difficult for everyone. It's a human level.
You're still on site.
Yeah, we are, and I think we're probably representative of most members in that. We are still active. Last week we were down at about a quarter of our capacity. This week we've seen a couple more sites open. Next week there is a possibility that we'll actually be back up to 100% output again, which is pretty incredible.
Obviously, how are you coping with the site operating procedures?
We're fortunate. We've had to make some adjustments. Piling is probably
just
less.
For those who don't know, that means that everyone's got to stay 2 meters apart, apart from anything else.
Well, it depends which version of the site operation procedures you're looking at. There, we've made adjustments to our procedures. Piling, we tend to work in relatively small crews. There's not many other people on site at the time. We tend to travel in vans. And what we've done as central piling is say, look, if you want to travel individually, you can do that. If you want to work a shorter shift, work through your breaks, work a 6-hour shift, don't work an 8 or a 9-hour shift, having breaks throughout the day. So you then haven't got to use the welfare facilities and have issues there in terms of social distancing. So we work with people. We've also spent a lot of time talking to our staff and understanding their particular circumstances and their risks as individuals, but not just them, their family units as well.
Of course.
And who is high risk. And from an FPS level, we've been sharing those ideas. So the operations and safety committee have sat down, and we've looked at best practice throughout the industry and right. seen how we can get working. But I understand there'll be people listening to this that probably don't work in the construction sector and understand people's concerns about why we have been operational. And apparently, if I was making those decisions in government, would I have said, yeah, let's carry on with all these construction sites in London a few weeks ago? I'm not sure I would have, because there's certainly a lot of trades where it's extremely difficult to distance themselves. We're more fortunate than most when we've satisfied ourselves that the way we're doing it, we've really mitigated the risk to our people and their families to really quite a negligible level. Mm-hmm. But you know, every day we go to a construction site, there are risks. So,
have you had any employees fall ill yet from COVID-19?
No positive cases in terms of people that have been admitted to hospital. There's people with symptoms, but as you know, it's been difficult to get tests on people unless you're sufficiently seriously ill to get a hospital admission. So again, we've been fortunate in that regard. But I think probably it's fair to say that all of us have known someone that have been affected. I certainly have. And unfortunately, people that have passed away. So it's a real illness, and there's some really vulnerable people out there. So we've got to be sensible in the precautions that we take. But there are more positive signs out there. I'm sure we're all sort of glued to that daily news conference and seeing what the latest statistics are and seeing if you know, the trends are going in the right direction. And I think there are, you know, construction certainly is open for business.
Excellent. Well, it's good to hear that your company is looking at a full order book and getting back to work again. Maybe you could tell us now about, you know, what your plans are for the FPS now that you're in the chair. You've got an agenda for change, I assume. Anything, have you had to revise that since the COVID outbreak?
I imagine that you mentioned the stress management. I can imagine that's climbed higher up the agenda than you initially thought it was.
It's occupational health and mental and physical health has always been a high priority of mine. It's more important now than ever. So one of the things we're doing actually is a project on fatigue. A few people say, you know, is this the right time to be doing a project? Yes, because our immune systems are so impacted by fatigue. You know, it's important that we really look after our bodies at this time, more important than ever. And we know that in construction, we work very long hours, we travel for a long time to site, and you know, we need to get a better understanding about what that is doing. And
have you got specialists advising you on that? I mean, have you got clinicians and
So there's we're working with a Canadian company called Fatigue Science, and they provide wristband technology to look at how many hours sleep you get in a day, and therefore when you would be at risk of fatigue, and they've done a link between how fatigue compares with drink driving. You haven't got to lose a lot of sleep to actually be operating, you know, a vehicle like a drunk driver would. It's really enlightening. So it's about trying to educate our own people about doing different things, changing when you're going to drink a caffeinated drink. Try and stick to doing that in the morning rather than drinking it in the evening. You're going to get a better night's sleep. Changing when you're eating, doing exercise, eating the right things. That can all impact on your sleep and hence your fatigue. So, yeah, there's some education we've got around that. We also want to sort of look at culture and place less of an emphasis on alcohol. You know, let's face it, construction has been...
You're sounding like a 1990s continental football manager coming into the Premier League, telling drunken British footballers they've got to change their diet.
Well, it worked for Wenger for a few years, didn't it? I think, and then everyone caught up. But yeah, I mean, look, you don't get many Premier League footballers these days drinking lots because it's not good for them. All right, we still want to have social events, but what we don't want to do is have all of our social events in construction linked directly to alcohol. We want to say, look, there's a place for people to come, be healthy, live a good lifestyle, and work in construction. So, you know, we want to change the culture there.
How's going down?
As you can imagine, it's met with a few challenges because, as I say, it's part of how we do things. And so it takes some adjustment. But we will reach people that we haven't reached before. And another aspect, talking about reaching people, of what I want to develop is better diversity in the industry. Now,
I get the feeling that the piling industry probably isn't an especially diverse sector to begin with. It's
you've only got to go to an event or go to construction site to realise it doesn't represent what society looks like.
Right.
You don't need a survey. Well, there have been surveys, but you don't need a survey to tell you that there's not many women working on construction sites. We've got better representation in offices. But you've got to acknowledge that there is an issue there if you're going to be building a solution.
What's the age profile?
I guess that's probably more reflective. It may be a little aging, but again, when we're looking at such long hours within the construction industry, it's quite hard to bring people in, and that it tends to disproportionately affect women in terms of the hours that we work. But it's an issue for everyone working in the construction industry. And we need to be a bit more flexible about the solutions that we're offering. You know, why do we always need to do these really long hours? Can't we look at things like having short shifts? We are now, you know, I mentioned earlier about the COVID situation. We're doing 6-hour shifts. Well, why not look at doing 2 6-hour shifts? We actually get more output in a day. And then our people are able to go home and see their families in the evening.
That's interesting because we touched upon this in a previous podcast, didn't we, Phil, about flexible working and stuff like that. I mean, obviously a piling operator can't really work from home, but maybe changing the patterns of work is a way of making it a better working environment.
Yeah, I think we've got to see the opportunities in COVID, haven't we? You know, there have been positives, whereas we all thought, how on earth can we operate from home in terms of the office staff? Well, actually, it's proven to be pretty easy. And for a lot of people, they've struck a much better balance than they had in the past. Of course, there's more challenges with people that have got to go to site. But there are solutions out there. And I know that there are a number of companies, maybe not so much in the pine industry, but there are companies out there that have looked at the split shift solution to try and get more operatives working part-time hours, and that's got to be for the benefit of the industry. So we've got to look at those alternatives going forward.
Steve, I want to ask you, you talk about doing shorter shifts for better work-life balance and so on, but a lot of construction industry work is not near home. A lot of people are in digs to temporary accommodation. They're travelling away. I would have thought they wanted a longer shift and a shorter week, if anything.
Yeah, I mean that's true. There are groups of people, certainly within the construction industry at the moment, that would prefer that. But then it's about ensuring that actually when they come away from that place of work, that they're actually able to have a good amount of time off, not working sort of back-to-back 7-day shifts 12 hours a day.
What's the sort of profile of your guys? Are they working within an hour of where they live on the whole? It's mostly in London.
Yeah, it's a mix, and we tend to, most of our work is in the southeast of England, and probably 3/4 of them will be able to travel to site and return return home that evening. But it does vary, and yeah, if we can look at alternatives going forward. It's not going to change overnight because it's not just about the pine industry changing. It's about society changing. They've got to accept that the construction sites potentially will be open longer hours ultimately to fit in with these alternative methods.
How do you gauge the challenge of increasing the diversity in the sector? I mean, getting more racial minorities, more women, LGBTQ plus people. I mean, how do you attract a cohort of society that hasn't really ever considered construction, let alone piling, to be a career option for them? How the whole thing about changing working patterns and welfare facilities and stuff like that is part of that. But it must be a huge challenge, isn't it?
It is, yeah, because it's the way things have been done for so long. So we need to make sure that, first of all, the leadership are talking about these issues. And people have been pretty uncomfortable with doing that in the past because, understand, diversity, everyone's worried about tripping over their words. Well, you've got to go away and educate yourself, first of all.
Yes.
Let's try and understand what is going on. And be prepared to get out there and talk about it. You know, I want to set up ways of people from different backgrounds being able to see others from a similar background already working with the industry and get mentors and get a network so people can help each other. As I say, unless you're going to recognise that there is a problem there, you're not going to be able to change, are you? It goes for a lot of things in life. So I think we need to be quite introspective about this and look at what we can be doing better.
Do you think the industry will follow you readily? I mean, are they going to be resistant to any attempt to change their sort of limited diversity?
I think it can be hard to get people to acknowledge that there is a problem. You know, people say, well, we are fair, we've got equality. Well, equality is not the same as equity. Having the same opportunities at face value doesn't mean that's fair. And so we've got to awaken people to those prejudices that exist. And as leaders, in fact, at every level, we've got to stand up where we see bias and challenge it. Maybe we have got more difficulty than other industries, but so it's a societal problem. But let's try and help people working within our industry first of all.
Good luck with it.
Thank you very much.
Okay. Well, thanks very much to Steve Hadley, the chair of the Federation of Piling Specialists, for joining us in this week's Reconstruction podcast. We'll be here, David and I, same time next week. If you want to subscribe, you know where to find us on your regular podcast outlets, Apple, Deezer, or whichever one you prefer. And you can email us podcast@theconstructionindex.co.uk. But from David and I, goodbye.
Goodbye.
Thank you for listening to Reconstruction, the podcast from the Construction Index. To keep up to date with the latest construction news every day, visit theconstructionindex.co.uk.